I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a woman who nearly died from complications related to AIDS and who's now on a mission to make sure it doesn't happen to others. Devandia Roseborough says growing up, she had no father at home, no one to teach her about men. She suffered some abuse at an early age and went on to be a promiscuous young woman. Although she admired her mother, she couldn't face the thought of confiding in her.
I was scared of her reaction. It seemed like I had went back into my childhood, you know, not knowing what she would say. But when I finally answered the phone, she said, "Baby, why did you keep this from me?"
Devandia Roseborough says she's learned that she has to be explicit in telling her own story. That's the only way kids today will take her seriously. And it matters now, she says, because there are so many new cases of HIV/AIDS appearing in the southern U.S. I'll talk to her right after the news. Devandia Roseborough first got word that she was HIV positive a little over 4 years ago. At that time, she was a single mother, two little girls at home. And as she got sicker and sicker, she had time to think about how she got into this mess. She had to face the fact that she'd been way too promiscuous.
I had a self-esteem issue. I dealt with my weight. I dealt with being dark-skinned. I dealt with having thick glasses, heavy set, and an attitude. And the way that I could release the stress was through what I call an addiction that I had, and that was from sex.
Devandia says her HIV infection soon turned into AIDS, and there were long stretches of time she spent in the hospital when people thought she might not make it. However, she's back on her feet now and determined that other young women, including her own two daughters, don't go through the same thing. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Take a map of the U.S. and draw a line from west to east, right through the middle of the country, California to Virginia. Now, if you look south of that line, that's where you will find half of all the deaths from HIV/AIDS in America today. See, there was a time when the infection was thought to be an urban issue, but more and more it's spreading into rural parts of the country, and it's particularly hard on the African-American population. In places like Georgia, where blacks make up 30% of the population, they are now 60% of the new cases of HIV/AIDS. And African-American women, they're the most vulnerable. Devandia Roseborough says her own story is typical. She's a single mother, two kids at home. She didn't have time to get sick, but she knew something was wrong.
I would faint every morning at 5 o'clock after waking up with my gown sticking to my body. It was like I was in a cold sweat, but yet I was feverish. And I would go to the kitchen at 5 a.m. to go get me some ice to cool off, and then I would faint in the same spot at the same time each and every time that I would have one of those fainting spells. But I would just get up and shake it off and, you know, and say, "What's really going on?" and go on with my day, get my girls ready for school.
At that time in her life, Devandia was coordinating programs for at-risk youth at the Y. She hoped it was just stress, but she thought it might be HIV, so she got tested. The test came back negative. She got tested again, negative. Then she got tested a third time, and she remembers the very moment when the doctor confirmed she was HIV positive.
Honestly, I was numb. The clock had just struck 10:12 on the wall, and when he said that, my natural reaction was, "What do I do next?" I wasn't scared. I wasn't going out of my mind. I didn't want to cry. I didn't shed any tears at all. It was just, "What do I do next?"
Were you there with any friends, family, daughters, mother, any of that?
Well, my cousin went with me, but she was in the waiting room, so I was there alone. Actually, it was a doctor that I didn't even know because I was scared and I couldn't get to my doctor. I would have maybe had to wait maybe a couple of days to get in for an appointment, and I needed to go right away, so I went to an aging care clinic.
And did you tell your cousin as soon as you came out of the office?
Yeah, I did. I came out, and she was on the phone, and she said, "What did the doctor say?" I said, "Well, the doctor said I have HIV. Come on, let's go down and show Mars, and I want a burger. I'm hungry." Yeah.
Sounds like you were trying to change the subject.
Yeah, in a way.
When did it sink in, though?
Wow. I don't think it ever really sunk in. I mean, see, I honestly can't say that I had a time in the beginning where anything had to sink in. I know when I went to sleep, I had the test results on the pillow, and when I woke up, I was wishing that it was the rays from the sun shining on my pillow, but the test results were still there. And I remember slapping that test results like, man, how did you let this happen? And then after that, it was just, I got to start living.
You had told me earlier, Devandia, that you'd had a pretty active sexual past and that you'd had this suspicion that you might be HIV positive. When you got the test, was there a part of you going, well, I brought this on myself?
Yes and no. A part of me was going through what I call a metamorphosis. I experienced a lot in my young adult life, in my childhood, being molested, not having my father in my life to show me how a man is to treat a woman and what to expect from one. I went through the phase of drinking alcohol and smoking marijuana. So it left me looking for daddy and men. And yes, I was promiscuous. And I felt like that all the things that I had went to the doctor for, everything else was coming back fine. That was the only thing that just resonated in the back of my mind is, you're positive. And I prayed to God to allow me to be strong in whatever it is and have his way. Just have your way, Lord.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. In the weeks after Devandia Roseborough came to terms with being HIV positive, she came to rely on her faith even more. Her doctor put her immediately on antiretroviral drugs, but Devandia was still sick. Less than a month after she got her first diagnosis, she knew she had to go to the hospital.
I went to my bedroom to lie down because I was feeling kind of funny. And when I went in to my bedroom, I fell over my footboard and I had fainted again. So I called my cousin and I asked her to come and take me to the emergency room. And when I got over to the emergency room, that's when I realized that something was wrong. They admitted me and I was there for the next 23 days. An ID doctor came in, which is the infectious disease doctor at the hospital, and told me that I had AIDS. And I battled back and forth with him. I said, no, I have HIV, because I could live with that. I couldn't live with AIDS. AIDS to me meant death sentence at the time. HIV was something I could handle, I felt like. And he said, no, Ms. Roseborough, you have AIDS. He said, well, people are living longer now. And he placed his right hand on my knee, and the tears that was about to come, they went away. They went away, and I felt right then that I was going to be okay.
But you ended up staying in the hospital a long time.
Yes, I was there for 23 days. I couldn't walk. I had to have oxygen to breathe. I was hallucinating, lost 70 pounds, had to have fluid drained from my kidneys and my lungs, couldn't keep any food down. I was very sick. I was knocking at death's door. And basically, it was prayers. It wasn't nobody but God in that hospital, or the people that came around me, the hymns that were sung, the laying of the hands, the praying. That's what brought me back. And plus, my will to want to live. And when I was down, I had to look up. I had no other choice but to look up. The hardest part was forgiving myself. And then I have two daughters that I know I needed to be there for. So I had to be strong for them.
At that time, Devandia was 32 years old. Her eldest daughter, Pearl, was then 12. Her youngest daughter, Pumpkin, was 10. They knew their mother was sick, but Devandia wasn't ready to tell them the whole story until some months later when she had her strength back.
I brought the girls into the living room, and I told them we're going to have a family meeting. And I asked them what they knew about HIV and AIDS. And, of course, they knew because they went to the after-school program and summer camp where I worked. And I had various organizations to come in and talk about HIV and STDs to the students that I served. And my youngest daughter, she was a bit naive, but my oldest, she took it the worst because she saw death. My mommy's gonna die. She just screamed to the top of her lungs, and she took her little hands and just placed them over her ears, and she just screamed, no, 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 and she ran through the house and went in her room, and I had to calm her down.
What did you say to her? What could you say to her?
Well, I jumped up, and I ran after her, and I said, Pearl, and I remember just saying, Pearl, calm down. Mama's gonna be okay. I'm fine. Look at me. And I just took her back. Actually, to where I was, 3 months ago, you know, prior to that conversation, how I was laying in that bed and she had to grease my scalp and wipe my lips with Vaseline and clean out my sink, and mommy couldn't do too much of anything and barely could speak without putting a mask over to get oxygen. I say, look at me. God is not through with me. I say, do you believe? And she was like, yeah. I say, well, have faith. I'm going to be okay. So I had to get counseling for both the girls. The main thing I let them know is, especially with my youngest daughter, when she asked me one day at McDonald's, she said, Mom, do you have AIDS? And I said, yes. And she asked me how I got it, and I told her having unprotected sex. And I went on with the wait till you get married, finish school, and go to college, and get your degree, and get your home, and purchase your car, and wait on God to see in your king. Don't go out and pick and choose, because behind your choices, there are consequences. Your temple is not yours. She said, well, Mom, are you going to die? And I said, well, sweetheart, we are going to die. We live to die. It's what we do in between that determines where our soul rests. And then she said, oh, okay, well, do you want some ketchup for your fries? And I said, yes. And that was it. I mean, her little mind was just at ease with that common conversation in McDonald's, where my oldest daughter, a couple of weeks after, she said, well, Mom, I forget you have HIV. I said, well, I don't, and keep dusting. We're not going to claim it. We are not going to claim it. So I try to make it, you know, easy for them by letting them see me be strong. I need them to see me strong.
Since then, Devandia Roseborough says the fact that she has AIDS has become a part of her daughter's understanding. She says it's not a secret anymore. It's even something that's talked about at school.
Well, I know kids have come up to them and asked them questions in regards to, is this your mom? Your last name is Roseborough. Is Roseborough your mother? And my oldest daughter actually has gotten me a couple of girls that wanted to interview me, which they did interview me for their senior exit paper. They did some thesis on HIV and AIDS. So that was awesome. And then my youngest daughter, she goes in, when she does her report, she has to stand in front of the class. So she also, you know, has the HIV and AIDS facts, and she's educating as well. And she told me one day that a little boy had asked, well, how did your mom get AIDS? And the teacher had stopped and said, well, you can't ask her that. That's none of your business. You know, and Pumpkin said, well, it's okay. I can tell them. It's not a problem. She speaks out on it, and it's not a problem at all.
Over the past 4 years, Devandia has grown healthier and stronger. Now she takes her message into high school classes, where she says she gives it straight to the students, and the questions that come back to her are every bit as direct. More on that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. I'm talking with Devandia Roseborough. She's a woman from Charlotte, North Carolina, who came close to dying from AIDS a few years back. She's now one of the people who's working to make sure that what happened to her doesn't happen to others. See, the rate of HIV infection and deaths related to AIDS are higher among black Southern women than pretty well anywhere else in the U.S. After Devandia recovered, she decided to start talking with high school girls. One of her favorite ways to get their attention is to play them the Nelly Furtado song, Promiscuous. So she plays this song for the kids, and they're listening, and then she asks them a question.
I say, what's the name of this song? You know, I go out and I start speaking, and I say, I was promiscuous. Do you know what promiscuous mean? And sometimes they'll say, well, that's that Nelly Furtado song. I say, well, sing it. And they'll sing it, get the bobbing the head and popping their fingers, and I say, well, what does it mean? And they cannot tell you. And then they give them the definition. They're like, oh, my God. I said, we have to be careful what's coming out your mouth now. So you a promiscuous girl? And they're like, no. Like, okay.
I want you on my team. So does everybody else. Maybe we can keep it on the line. Devandia says her own confusion about men began when she was a little girl herself. Her father didn't live with her. He never showed up when he said he would. He was often behind on his child support. Devandia was also abused by one of her uncles. And looking back on that now, it still makes her uncomfortable.
It actually brought a good feeling to me, and I desired that feeling for some reason. And I downed myself thinking that you're not right. You're supposed to tell somebody, but at the same time, you're not supposed to feel this way. So I think I was longing. I know I was longing for that feeling again, but also wanting to have companionship and a man in my life, because I was missing what I felt like my father should have been there to tell me about, what not to do, and this is what a man is about, and show me how a man is supposed to be. And he wasn't there.
Devandia grew up with the secret of that abuse and the way it made her feel. Looking back, she sees a direct connection between those experiences and her own promiscuity.
It was on. I had a self-esteem issue. I dealt with my weight. I dealt with being dark-skinned. I dealt with having thick glasses, dark skin, heavy set, and an attitude, a real funky attitude, all because of the stuff that I endured. It was a burden on my shoulders. And the way that I could release the stress was through what I call an addiction that I had, and that was from sex, an addiction to sex.
So looking back at that time, can you figure out when or how or who gave you the HIV infection?
Being promiscuous? No. No.
Did you call anyone? Could you call anyone?
Yes.
Yeah.
Then a lady came in from the health department, and she said, I need to get names and numbers of everyone that you've been in contact with in the past 5 years. And I'm like, really? Wow. Okay. And we did what we could, you know, and the ones that I did get information, you know, for, all of them were negative. All of them were negative.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Devandia Roseborough was left to conclude just how random that kind of sexual encounter can be.
And I went to a party one day, and a guy that I knew that I had been with prior to his diagnosis, it didn't dawn on me to think about him, because he was no one I loved. He was somebody that bugged the you-know-what out of me. You know, he just wanted to get with me, and I was like, no, child, go ahead, leave me alone. You know, and then I finally gave in because I was intoxicated and had a little marijuana in my system. And it went down from there. And I tell everybody that 10 seconds wasn't worth my life. It wasn't worth my life. And to this day, I think I say, well, I know that he's positive. But back then, I didn't know. And I was like, wow. He walked up. He said, hey, Vonda. And I was like, hey. And in the inside, my body was like, you did this to me. You know, and I was like, wow, I couldn't move. It just, something just went through my body. Like, you're the one. But I couldn't say anything. I was just froze. I froze. And that's when the pressure came down on me. When you asked me in the beginning, when did I feel anything in regards to the diagnosis, that's when it came down on me. That's when I battled back and forth with God. Why me? Why did you let this happen to me? And I wanted to kill myself. I didn't want to live anymore. I was stressed out. I wanted to stop taking my medications, and I cried continuously. That's when all hell broke loose during that period.
How did you get out of that?
My mother, she had to shake me, and she had to tell me, you had a responsibility. You had a responsibility for your mind, body, and soul. You didn't ask him his status. You knew what yours was. You didn't provide a condom, nor did you tell him to go get one, and you didn't say no. So that's when I knew right then, I have as much fault in this as the person that I was involved with. especially me, because I have a responsibility for me, for my body.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. When Devandia Roseborough needed help, she went to a local support group for women with HIV/AIDS, and she made an important discovery.
Every one of the women in there had been molested. Every last one of the women had been molested. And some, you know, had went through some other things, and I was like, wow, I'm not alone. And through that support group, through that moment, I was allowed to get out what was going on with me, and that's when I talked to God, and God talked to me, and he said, you need to put it on paper. And I had a computer and printer and everything at home, but he directed me to the library, and he said, type it up at the library, and then take it to the mailbox and put it in the mail. But I knew it wouldn't take long for her to get it because we don't stay far from one another.
You mailed this and to your mother. You didn't tell her first.
I did. I chickened out.
Oh, wait a second. You got the information to her. That's not chickening out. It's just an interesting way
I
of
did.
Doing it. Were you waiting for her phone call then?
Well, I was. Yeah, I was waiting for her phone call, but when the phone rung and, you know, the caller ID, I ignored it. I was scared of her reaction. It seemed like I had went back into my childhood, you know, not knowing what she would say, if she would hurt or lash out at me, or why didn't you tell me? And, you know, just I didn't know, was she gonna place the blame on me? But when I finally answered the phone, she said, baby, why did you keep this from me? Why you been hiding from me? Please answer the phone. And I answered, and she said, Where did I go wrong? I said, Mother, it wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault. And she told me, you're grown. She said, if you want to, you know, go and confront these people, she said, I'm by your side. And I told her I forgave them a long time ago. But I never forgot.
I understand not wanting to blame your mother now. It doesn't prove anything. But I'm just wondering, when you look back at that time, if you were to kind of take a look at what maybe you needed from her, was there something you weren't getting?
Well, I wish I had more conversations with her. I wish we had a better relationship. I don't blame my father. I don't blame the people that molested me, and I don't blame the relationship that I did not have with my mother because my choices were mine.
When Devandia Roseborough talks with high school kids today, she spends a lot of her time talking about her choices and their choices. And because she's been there, when she talks about her decision, for example, to not use a condom, the kids listen to her.
I think it was when I got mad or when I was hurt, I felt like I needed to get back at the guy that I was with. And once I broke up with him, it was just, okay, I was just loosey-goosey. You know, sometimes I use condoms, and at other times, no.
So
other
you
times,
would,
no.
There'd be times when you wouldn't use a condom with a new partner as a way of somehow punishing the guy you just left. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and punishing myself. But at the end of the day, when you're intoxicated, you're impaired, you don't know. You forget. You're caught up in the heat of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you forget, or you don't think that. Sometimes it may even be on your mind, but don't want to sacrifice that moment or what he's going to say or what he's going to think. And there's guys out there, the young girl said that they don't want to have sex unless they can go in it without one because of the way it feels. I know young ladies said that the condoms irritate them. They want to feel the real deal. And I'm like, wow. What's the real deal when you have to have a needle this long? And I demonstrate how long the needle was when they stuck it in my back to get marrow out my bones. When you have to have oxygen to breathe. And if someone has on a black coat in the room to show them how dark my skin got. 107-degree fever and the pneumonia. And not being able to use the bathroom when I felt like I needed to go. Instead, it would just come on its own, and not knowing whether you're going to live or die. And then they sit there with this cloud over their head. And then that's when the questions start coming.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Devandia Roseborough is a young African-American woman who nearly died from complications related to AIDS. And when she talks with high school students about that, she uses music to get her message across, like this song from Life Jennings.
Mama's giving advice, but she ain't trying to hit A. Not because it's wrong, just her delivery is white.
Shay, get your mind in this house if I see you with another breast.
Life is rough. You say that you're not ready for sex, but you're in love. He says if you really loved him, you would give it up. But your mama says that's just a lie.
Devandia says kids today like to give the impression that they know everything they need to know about sex, but that's just not the case.
And the young lady said, well, I went to the doctor last week, and I had 3 STDs, and I'm taking 3 different medications. Should I be worried? I said, yes, you should. You should be worried. And I asked if she had an HIV test, and she said yes. And she said, well, it came back negative. I say, mine did also. I said, but yes, you should be worried. Because, you know, HIV can lie dormant in your body and not be detected for up to 10 years. And she just cried like a baby. You know, and I've had older women to come up to me and tell me, you know, I was promiscuous and I shot up drugs and I was a prostitute and I used to get high and Lord knows it could have been me. I said, but you was, by his mercy and grace, it wasn't you. So I let them know I was the chosen one, because everyone that I speak to basically says that if I got it, I don't want to know, or if I got it, I don't want to tell anybody. Or if I got it, I'm going to kill myself. You know, so God needed somebody to remain around that didn't mind talking about it. And like my mother says, he has him a mouthpiece.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Devandia Roseborough says it's not just kids who get her advice. She finds that she's also called on to answer the questions of her adult friends as well. And even with them, she doesn't mince her words.
A friend of mine called me on the phone and she said, Vonda, I need to talk to you. And I said, okay. And a lot of my friends think I know everything when it comes to sex for some reason. And she said that she was having an affair with a guy in her night class. And I was like, okay, you're married. And she's like, wait a minute, please don't judge, just listen. And I said, okay, I'll be fair. And I listened. And she told me about the things that went on, and she said that when she closed her eyes, she saw me. And I was like, fool, you should have got up. You know? What's wrong with you? You just laid there with me on top of you and him on top of me? Come on. And she said, I asked her, did she use a condom? And she said, no. And actually, she found out. I said, well, what if you take something back to your husband? Or what if you get pregnant by this man? You know, you got to live with that. Well, long story short, she found out that she contracted an STD from the man. And she flipped it around and made it seem as if the husband had gave it to her. And come to find out, he ran with it and fell for it. And he had been messing around on her, too. You know, so it was like, wow. Yeah.
What's the lesson to that story?
If you see me, run. Yeah, if you see me, run.
Or at least put a condom on.
Yes, put a condom on.
She's been down and out. She's been wrote about. She's been talked about constantly. She's been up and down. She's been pushed around, but they held her down. NYC. She has no regrets. She accepts the past. All these things they help to make she. She's been lost and found, and she's still around. There's a reason for everything. Yeah. You know I've been holding on. Tried to make me weak, but I still stay strong. Yeah. Put my life all up in these songs, just so you can feel me, so you can get through. So take me.
Devandia Roseborough lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. She has a new book about her experience with HIV/AIDS. It's called put it on paper. We have a link to that and to her organization. It's called the Raspberry Rose Foundation. You can find all those links on our website at thestory.org.
She's older now, yes, she's wiser now, can't disguise her now. She don't need no one telling her what to do and say, no one telling her who to be. She's on solid ground, she's been lost and found. Now she answers to G-O-D, and she's confident this is not the end. Ask me how I know, cause she is me.
In just a moment, we'll get another perspective on the rise in HIV/AIDS among African Americans. This time from the guy's side, Chris Cathcart has written an essay called A Message to My Straight Brothers, It's Time to Talk About Our Homophobia. He says that the hypermasculine self-image of the young man today encourages the perspective of women as conquests. And it also allows them to pretend that HIV/AIDS, well, could never happen to them. That's coming up next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story.
I can only be me. I can only be me. Yeah. I can only be me.
So it's all or nothing at all.
Oh,
all or nothing at all.
Oh,
you know
all or nothing. I can only be me. Yeah.
Take me
as I am.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. As we heard a couple of moments ago, Devandia Roseborough gets her message across about the risks of HIV/AIDS by being direct with the kids. But there is a big part of this story where a lack of directness comes into play. And I'll be blunt, it's homophobia. You see, as long as young men perpetuate their locker room chatter about who's gay or he's a sissy or he's, well, you know the words, as long as that goes on, then those same young men can perpetuate the myth that HIV/AIDS is something unique to the gay community. Chris Cathcart works with a variety of nonprofit organizations, including the Black AIDS Institute. But he's not here as a spokesman. He's here to tell his story about his own struggle with homophobia as a straight black man. Chris says it began all the way back in grade school. There was one boy who seemed different from Chris and the others there.
Second grade was the first time that I encountered someone that we called a sissy, you know, not knowing what that meant, but knowing that he didn't act like us. Mm-hmm. No one really set us down and said, okay, this is the term you use and these are the reasons you use it. He was the first male that I noticed act slightly effeminate, not knowing what the word effeminate meant, but he was effeminate in action. He didn't play sports. He didn't hang out. We were all roughnecks. We all played as many sports as we could fit into a 24-hour period in a day, and he didn't.
So how did you treat him?
We didn't treat him good. We called him a sissy and other names. And basically that set the standard for how, as men growing up, we treated other guys who acted like him.
Can you think back to any adults whose behavior you were emulating? I don't know, the barbershop, for example. Would you hear talk in the barbershop?
I remember going to the barbershop and sitting there with those men who bantered back and forth about the issues of the day and women and sports and politics. It's a very manly, macho experience. At that time, and I grew up in this period of time, it was the mid-70s, late 70s, so it was a lot of the black exploitation film era. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with that, but that's the era of Shaft and Superfly and the Mac. So a lot of the conversations get around issues that were, you know, main topics of those type of movies, violence, sexual conquests, nice cars, clothes. If you probably went to any hundreds of barbershops during that era, the conversations are all pretty similar.
Yeah, I remember hearing grown-ups use language and use words that weren't used at the dinner table, and that made it kind of alluring in a way. It kind of drew me in. Do you know what I mean?
I remember when I first started cursing, using curse words, and that obviously wasn't in the house.
Yeah.
I ran the streets with the best of them, but I was a pretty good kid, and I understood what was to be said inside and what was to be said outside the house. But I'm telling you, on the streets, on the playground, when you hopped on your sissy bar handle banana seat bike and rode up to the playground and hung out with the guys, those are the terms that became ingrained in how you communicated. And that was when you heard disparaging words about homosexuals and you wanted to be a part of it.
Do you remember any times in middle school, for example, when you as a part of a group of guys would again be critical of kids because, you know, you thought they were gay or you thought they're homosexual?
Yeah, man. I mean, I guess it was about the eighth grade. I was walking with a bunch of friends. There were a couple of guys up in front of us. One of the guys was the young guy I was talking about earlier, but now he's with a couple of buddies who would also be classified as sissy, for lack of a better term. And I remember one of the guys I was walking with, one of them yelled, "Oh, that's such and such. Look at them. Look at those guys, man. What are they doing over here? Look." And just picked up a rock and, like, threw it. Another guy picked up a rock. It didn't really hit him. It skipped near him, but enough that it was disturbing. And I mean, once again, we're not little kids. I mean, it's not little boys tossing rocks across the street. We were old enough to know what you should and shouldn't be doing, and that was definitely wrong. And I remember feeling not right about that. I didn't say anything, and I regret even to this day not saying anything then.
When you look back at that, what is it about that experience that bugs you? I mean, it would have taken a fair amount of independence to say, hey, guys, that's wrong. It's just easier, you know, to go along with the flow.
And you know what? I wish I had been that strong. I mean, it wasn't right from a human standpoint. And I've always regretted I didn't at least say stop or why are you guys doing that? I mean, one of the worst things you could say about any guy was that he was gay or suggest that he might be. And it's amazing how you can get into, I remember in high school, it was remotely considered that someone was suspect, quote unquote. I mean, that rumor could take on life and grow from a pebble to a mountain in a very short period of time.
Did you use that word, that guy's suspect?
More so when I was in college than in high school. I heard he was suspect. Yeah. Oh, that guy's suspect. I don't know about him. Yeah, somebody saw him hanging out someplace.
The idea being that you could start a rumor about someone which they'd carry with them for years.
For years. This wasn't that long ago, so it's not like I'm talking about a time when we didn't have access to more relevant information, but there was no sensitivity training, whatever that means. There were no conversations, no administrators in school. I don't remember anybody ever having discussions about respect for alternative lifestyles. We'd have meetings about safety or, you know, some other issue going on that would be, you know, important to the students. General assemblies we get together, but never about how to treat people.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Chris Cathcart is talking about the ultra-masculine environment that he grew up in and the language that's a part of that. What's clear is that this unofficial education Chris got didn't end in grade school or high school. It continued well into his college years.
I was an athlete. I played sports my whole time coming up. Mm-hmm. And you always had the guys who were like superior athletes and you had guys who were like okay. And then there were the guys that we considered fags and they didn't play any sports. And I remember one day in gym class, we used to have this game we called a bombardment. It was more or less team dodgeball. You know, guys would be in there. If you catch the ball, you're out. And if you hit the guy, he's out. And so the guys who were fags or sissies never would play this game. They would just stand to the side. And I remember one day they would stand to the side, and a couple of my friends just got the balls and just started, like, hitting these guys, man. And they weren't even playing and just, like, nailing them with the ball. And I think the gym teacher eventually said something, but not enough, not soon enough, not in the right terms.
When you look back on that, Chris, have you figured it out? I mean, was it really a kind of hatred that motivated that? Or was it about the supposedly straight guys trying to establish their masculinity by saying, oh, no, that's not me. That's not me. As a matter of fact, it's so not me, I'm going to throw a rock at it or a basketball at it.
It wasn't just hatred. I don't think there was enough understanding about the issues of sexuality for it to be something that was that simple.
Yeah,
it was more about the complicated aspect of men trying to be men and not knowing how to do it, not knowing what black male sexuality is. I don't really know what that is now. I know that it's something that you have to at least admit that you're something you strive for and try to better understand. And not having the tools to work those things out back then, you acted out instinctively. And instinctively, you wanted to say, okay, I'm not those guys. Whatever I am, I'm not them. And I think that it just stayed with us as we became adults, and that's wrong.
And what about college? How did this change when you got older and went to college?
It didn't. It's just like everything else. It moved to a higher level. At college, it was even more acute. I played football, and I went on a football scholarship. And that's when a lot of machismo came with how you define yourself. That's when the term suspect really came into effect. Like, oh, he's suspect. I saw him hanging out with somebody. I heard he was at some club. And so, you know, you work diligently to not be labeled as such. And so how did you do that? We used to hang out, we drank beer, and most importantly, you tried to get as many female sexual conquests as you can get your hands on it.
Why? Because this was the a mark of masculinity to see
because
how...
Because that was that the more women you could score with, the more manly you were considered. You have to have some stories when you guys gather around, you know, the street corner or drinking beer on the stoop or whatever it was. You can't be the guy who doesn't have any conquest stories.
And now we're not just talking about attitudes towards homosexuality. We're talking about attitudes towards women as well, right?
Right, but in the plane of it trying to help you define your own sexuality.
Right.
These things, they're all laid on the table together. How many stories can you share? How much more sensational is your story than the next guy? And in that same breath, clearly I'm not a fag. I'm not one of these guys.
You know, Chris, I have to tell you something. I know men who are 40 and 50 years old who still talk the same way. Some people never really change that. You did, and I'm wondering if you know when or how that happened.
I mean, you know. With all due respect, and I appreciate that, I am tremendously a work in progress. I still use terms to myself in certain circles that I am not proud of. What I am proud of, though, if I may say, is that I have been willing to grow and to adapt and to change and to recognize that it's wrong. And I have lots of friends, very educated friends, who still harbor and hold those same attitudes we had in college. It's very difficult to shake that. And I don't think it's something that one generation is going to be able to change. It's going to take some time to weed all that out. And for myself, I'm always struggling with it.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. My guest is Chris Cathcart. College was also where Chris began to look at things a little differently.
I can remember in college, I had a girlfriend who saw me hanging out with a guy, you know, just in the pub at the school, just sitting down talking. And she asked me later, why were you with him? Isn't he gay? And I went, I don't really know, but I hadn't really thought about it, and I don't think that really matters. I mean, he's cool with me, and I'm cool with him. And she's like, well, you know, it just seems strange you're hanging out with a guy that's gay. And I went, I don't really understand why that would be strange. Obviously, we're dating, so you know my sexuality, at least I hope.
Were you ever hit on by a gay guy?
Sure. It was one time when after I got out of school, there was a guy who actually I went to school with. And I was sitting in the backseat of the car, and he was driving the car, and it was another friend of mine in the passenger side, and he had his hand behind the seat. And he was rubbing the inside of my leg with his hand. And I said, okay, well, I'm not thinking about it. I said, okay, his hand's just hanging over the back of the seat, and he must not know he's doing that, so I'll just move my leg over a little bit. And he moved his hand over and rubbed the inside of my leg a little bit more. So I kind of lost it, and I yelled at him, and I grabbed him by the collar. He pulled over the car, and I pulled him out the car, and I said, man, what are you doing? And I used really harsh language. I didn't hit the guy, but I was really upset. And you know what I was most upset about? I wanted to find out what made him think that was cool to do that to me. What about me has suggested that that was even possible?
Mm-hmm.
And that spoke right to my own idea of sexuality. I think almost instantly my mind went past a little incident to, okay, am I doing something? Is it something I've said? Is it somewhere I wear my clothes? Is it someplace someone's seen me? I'm going down the list, life's list. I mean, how did this happen?
That incident Chris Cathcart describes also allowed him to imagine what life looked like through the eyes of gay black men. What he saw transformed him.
There's a whole other world that these guys have lived with and gone through, a much tortured world, due in great part to guys like myself over the years, that we don't know anything about. And a lot of the HIV/AIDS events I go to, more often than not, I'm in the minority when it comes to heterosexual men. So you see guys who very casually talk about their partners and their relationships, you know, make jokes about some handsome guy they saw or some actor they think is cute. Mm-hmm. And they do it without any kind of, well, Chris, excuse us while we be gay in front of you. It's just like they do their thing. And I start going, okay, they're not that much different than when I get with my friends and we talk about the Halle Berrys and the Beyoncés mm-hmm. and this thing and that thing. It's very similar, just different.
Almost everything that you have said, well, everything that you've said so far, from my perspective, because I'm white, you know, applies as much in my own experience as yours. And yet, you've written a piece recently in the collection of essays called Not in My Family, where you say, okay, this is a message to my straight brothers. We straight black men still allow homophobia to cripple our thinking and our actions. And you talk about how one of the most important lessons growing up is that real black men weren't gay. Is there an element to this work that you do? Is there an element to your attitude now that deals directly with the African-American side of homophobia? Is there any kind of distinction there?
Yes, and the most specific reason is because in many ways, the HIV/AIDS issue is decimating the African-American community disproportionately to other communities around the country. And we have a role and a responsibility as black men. You know, we can't just see the fight to gay black men or women or activists. We need all men involved. But unless we deal with the homophobia, because we can't really talk about the HIV/AIDS issue as black men until we deal with the homophobia. I didn't understand that initially. I thought it's a health crisis. Okay, we'll roll up our sleeves and we'll come to the table and we'll get some work done. But when I started talking to straight black men, once again, from all cuts, I started realizing that they fundamentally could not get past the fact that it was disproportionately affecting the gay community. And I've been working on the AIDS issue about 8 years now. I still get the, why are you doing it? Oh, I think it's so cool, Chris, that you're involved with this, man. You're so community conscious. You know, you really want to give back. That's cool. But the AIDS thing, man, what? Why are you doing it?
Well, you think people are looking for an answer, Chris, like, what, has he got a gay brother or something? Why is he involved? It's like you have to have some kind
I get that. Is somebody in your family gay? Did you lose somebody to AIDS? Because we know you're not gay. Then it's kind of like, right? That's not said, though.
I wonder if in the time that you've spent talking to people about this issue, you've ever had the satisfaction of someone coming up to you and saying, you know what, that homophobic, you know, straight black male person that you're describing who wants to keep anything that's homosexual at arm's length because it's a threat, that's me. And I didn't really get it until I heard you describe it.
One time in particular, I spoke on a panel in Washington, D.C., and there's a guy, I didn't know him directly. We're familiar through college friends, and he mentioned afterwards that he really appreciated the work I was doing. And, you know, basically he was saying he was apologizing more or less for not doing it sooner or not doing more. But the interesting thing, though, is that a lot of guys who are gay come up to me. One guy in tears in Washington who came up and hugged me, and he said, I really appreciate the work that you're doing. I can't tell you how important it is. And, you know, I told him, as much as I appreciate what he said, I said, I still can't never really understand what you've gone through. To be black, male, and gay in America, I can't imagine what your day-to-day life had been like growing up when you were shunned from, you know, all the institutions that we take for granted, the barbershops, the churches, the community centers, the schools, all the little groups and organizations that we socialize with in our neighborhoods, oftentimes went open to these guys. I kind of apologized to him. I said, you know, I'm sorry it took so long.
Chris Cathcart is president of the consulting firm One Diaspora Group. He wrote an essay called A Message to My Straight Brothers. It's time to talk about our homophobia, and it's included in a book called Not in the Family, AIDS in the African American Community. You can read more about Chris and links to his work on our website. That's at thestory.org. Also, if you have a story that gives us a new or different perspective on HIV/AIDS today, or if you've got something you'd like to talk to me about that you heard on today's program, I'd like to hear from you. You can go to our website, once again, thestory.org, and leave me a message there, or call and leave me a message on our telephone line, 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Coming up tomorrow on The Story, a business story. Allison Wright owns and operates a micro business. She's a picture framer. Her business is new, so Allison's been hiring staff, including her business manager, Clay Bowles. Now, Allison has Down syndrome, so Clay was a critical hire for her. And I asked Allison if she remembered hiring Clay.
I hired a long time ago.
Was there a job interview?
Yes. Yes, this is a job interview.
You interviewed Clay, is that right?
Yes.
What questions did you ask him?
I asked him how to do the frames, how to do the safety, how to do the trash can.
How to empty the trash?
Yeah, I went through a series of interviews. I went through one with my supervisor. I went through one with Allison. And as I was, you know, walking into the cubicle to go do this interview, I was like, all right, you know, I ain't going to be nervous. You know, I can do this. First question Allison asked me, can you take out the trash? I'm like, well, wait a second. I'm trying to be a business manager, not a janitor. I said, Allison, I can take out the trash. And then she goes, are you clean? Is your area clean? I'm like, well, yes. She hired me, and then I've been happy ever since.
That's Clay Bowles. He'll be here talking about his new job. Allison Wright will also be here, along with her father, Edward Wright, as we take a perspective on a slightly different business story. That's tomorrow on the program. You often hear me say on the program that if you have a reaction to a story or something on a particular topic, I'd like to hear from you. Just want to remind you that if you have a story that you want to hear on the program or tell on the program or something you'd like to turn our attention to, I'd also like to hear from you. Simplest way is go to our website at thestory.org and you can leave me a message there. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
American Public Media.